So yes, we're coming to the end of a journey of the last, well, it'll be 7 weeks altogether. And I was thinking, while I was meditating, as you do, I was thinking, I've never done this before, actually. I've never given a series of seven talks at a class. I've done it on retreat, you know, day after day, so it's quite something. I'm really enjoying it, by the way. But it is coming to an end, and we did talk earlier on, or I talked earlier on, about I used an aerodynamic metaphor of having had a very steep takeoff. The first 3 points were quite full and quite challenging, and then we were kind of cruising through points 4 and 5, and now we're beginning to make our descent, so we've got to strap our seatbelts on. But still, quite a lot of material to go. So I'm not going to do a resume this week. I'm just going to plunge into this last penultimate point. So the last 2 points of the mind training are concerned with pledges or promises or commitments. That's point number 6 of the mind training. And then the point next week is precepts of mind training. So this week we've got 16 aphorisms or slogans, and next week we've got 21. So quite a lot of points. And sometimes I find it quite hard to see what the difference is between the commitments, pledges and promises, point 6, and the precepts of point 7. Sometimes they seem to me to be quite similar. But some commentators say that the commitments, when I say that, I can't help but think of that movie, so that's why I called it pledges and promises. But the promises and the pledges are said to be associated with the perfection of wisdom. And the precepts are concerned much more with our everyday life experience. But still, if you know, when we've done them all, if you can sort of see the difference, let me know. I think the main thing is that they both help us to develop and maintain the mind training so that we don't deviate from our mind training. And we need to remember from previous talks, previous weeks, that we're very much on the path of transformation. So we talked about the path being a path of vision and a path of transformation. So that the vision experience is where you touch into something completely, the mystery, completely beyond your present experience, something transcendental. And the path of transformation is to make that kind of stable in every aspect of your life. So the path of vision can be, in a way it's timeless, because it's outside of time if you have that kind of glimpse, but it can just be a moment. And the path of transformation is long. In the Mahayana tradition, they talk about the aspiration aspect of the bodhicitta and the establishment aspect of the bodhicitta. And if you remember this text, its main purpose is to develop bodhicitta, that mind of enlightenment for all sentient beings. So we're very much on the path of transformation. And these commitments, pledges and promises, or the precepts or the disciplines, are very much to establish us in that glimpse, in that path of vision. So they're to help us support our intention, never to be separated from the two bodhicittas. So yes, the commitments, the pledges, the promises are often said to be associated with the perfection of wisdom. And in this sense, it means that they're there to sharpen our intelligence. This is how it's sometimes put. To sharpen our intelligence, to help us work with ourselves, to help us work with our habits and our mind. To use prajna, intelligence, wisdom, as it were, to cut through our habitual tendency to ego-grasping, ego-clinging, self-clinging. So point number 6, yes, is referred to as commitments, pledges and promises of the mind training. So they're quite strong terms and words. So commitment means, if you look in the dictionary, English dictionary, a duty, an obligation, a responsibility, an undertaking, a guarantee, a pledge, a promise, one's word. It also has connotations of dedication and devotion. So pledge means a solemn promise or agreement, which is binding. Your word of honour. And a promise means an undertaking, an assurance, a guarantee. So, you know, you can see they're quite similar, slightly different connotations. So I was reminded of that. I think it used to happen in coffee houses in the city, in the start of the stock exchange. My word is my bond. My word is my bond. Your word was enough. Your word was trustworthy. So it has that kind of sense about it, isn't it? You know, you give your word and that really means something. So here you're giving your word, as it were, to your practice of mind training. I'm not sure what the people translate as commitments, pledges and promises is a translation of, but often a word used in Buddhism is samaya, which means bond, and the Tibetan word is damshig. So sometimes that's translated as faithful, which is interesting. I think it's usually translated as bond. But you may have come across green Tara, sometimes called Samaya Tara, the faithful Tara. So it's interesting, this word Samaya or bond. Sometimes it's a bond between a teacher and a disciple. Sometimes there is a list of samayas, which are precepts in the Tibetan tantric tradition. But in a more general sense, I think it just means, you know, a commitment, a bond. But Lama Govinda, in one of his books, talks about samaya or damshig. And he says of Samaya Tara that she's that embodiment of faithful devotion which is born of love and strengthened by the bodhisattva vow to liberate all beings. And then Samaya in general, or Damshig, he says, is the devotion for the Buddha in one's own heart. It's a bond of inner relationship through the power of loving devotion, by which the devotee devotes him or herself to the Buddha and Dharma. So it's devotion for the Buddha in one's own heart. It's a bond of inner relationship through the power of loving kindness, by which the devotee devotes him or herself to the Buddha and Dharma. So he says samaya or damshig is an attitude of deep reverence for that which surpasses words and reasons, an attitude without which all symbols would lose their power and significance. So again, you've got this sense of something quite inner. It's an inner commitment. It's a commitment you make to this inner relationship to the Buddha, the Dharma, and to the Sangha. And it has this connotation of devotion, deep reverence. So that's the kind of, I think this is what we're talking about in this point. So we're not just talking about you know, duty, obligation, responsibility. That can sound a bit grit your teeth and do it sometimes, can't it? It's got this kind of very strong inner commitment out of loving kindness, out of devotion to your practice. So yes, you get a sense of something very strong that's heartfelt and devotional. So it's not something extrinsic or external, is it? Where it arises for the bodhisattva, the trainee bodhisattva, novice bodhisattva, us as novice bodhisattvas, have had some kind of glimpse, a glimpse of a glimpse, or a glimmer of a glimmer, of that ultimate bodhicitta, that supreme value, that mind of wisdom and compassion, emptiness and compassion, that experience that is so valuable, so meaningful, beyond all words, all concepts, time and space, that only symbols and metaphors can point to, which we talked about in point one. So if you've had an experience of that nature, something of that nature has erupted in you, risen in you, you've touched into it, and I'm sure we all have to some extent, because I think you wouldn't be practicing otherwise. Well, since something like that has happened to one, however brief, I think the natural response from this inner connection with that is to want to honour it, deepen it, maintain it, allow it to manifest more and more in your life, and bring about a total transformation. So I think this is what we're talking about, this kind of quality that we're talking about in the pledges, promises and commitments of mind training. So it's not just rules and regulations in a kind of external way, divorced from inner experience. So nevertheless, they tend to be couched in terms of thou shalt not. Don't do this and don't do that. So their aim is to encourage us to refrain from certain actions and mental states which go against our experience of or our aspiration to develop bodhicitta. So to keep us on track, as it were. So in some ways we're in very basic dharmic territory of the four right efforts, which if you remember are to prevent unskillful mental states from arising, and if they arise, to deal with them quickly. That's the first two. So if we do that, if we kind of refrain, if we don't give way to certain mental states, actions, then the bodhicitta, that mind and heart of loving kindness and compassion, can grow. So it's a bit like clearing away the weeds, as it were. So that the seeds of positive action, the seeds of faith and bodhicitta can grow. So both the commitments and the precepts of point 7, have certain similarities to a list of bodhisattva precepts, of which there are 64. I think that's not surprising, really, because we're in Mahayana territory. I think the principle of precepts or commitments or guidelines, or whatever you like to call them, has very much been outlined by Sangharakshita. So he talks about going for refuge as this, in a way, vision experience, going for refuge to the three jewels. He talks about that experience as being primary, existential, crucial, real, you know, kind of something you can't quite describe, but something very profound. You go for refuge, you turn away from mundane interests as your priority, you turn towards the three jewels, you turn towards the transcendental. And that experience, which he describes, has all kinds of levels and all kinds of dimensions. So he talks about the altruistic dimension of going for refuge. He uses that experience, going for refuge, as the primary experience out of which everything else comes. So the altruistic dimension, which is not a very poetic way of describing it, but out of that dimension is the whole bodhisattva ideal and all its richness and wonder, expressing that altruistic dimension. So when Sangharakshita talks about going for refuge, he talks about going for refuge as that primary, existential, crucial, central experience being expressed in precepts, being expressed in the 5 or 10 precepts, which are principles and also rules of training. And he describes the precepts as the lifeblood of the heartbeat of going for refuge. So again, you've got a very strong relationship between that inner experience and that outer expression in terms of precepts. So it's the same thing with the bodhisattva precepts, the bodhisattva vow and the bodhisattva precepts, and the same thing with the mind training commitments and precepts. They're the lifeblood of the mind training, they're the lifeblood of that bodhicitta experience, which we've touched into. So that's to give you a bit of a preamble. So to turn to the text, and we're looking at two texts. So we're looking at a teacher's text, which is a series of 7 quite pithy verses, and then we're looking at a text by Chikawa, who takes those pithy verses and extrapolates them into 57 or 59, depending on which one you're looking at, pithy aphorisms or sayings. So Atisha says, "By the gracious Lama's blessings, may I keep my promises, be free of hypocrisy, and have no partiality and little outward show, protecting the commitments of the mind training as I would my own life." So it's considered very important in Buddhism generally to keep promises, to keep precepts taken. And especially in the mind training, though I think generally in Buddhism anyway, any kind of hypocrisy or mere outward show is not considered a good thing. So there are quite a lot of mind training commitments and precepts in these two points, which are about not boasting, not showing off, practicing and staying natural, and certainly not pretending to be more spiritual than you actually are. Very bad thing. So hypocrisy means to profess standards, beliefs contrary to one's real character or behaviour. So it implies deceit, deception and lack of sincerity, which is completely antithetical to you know, your love for all sentient beings, your desire to be open and honest and straightforward with them. So then he says, protecting the commitments of the mind training as I would my own life. So that commitments or precepts, guidelines, are taken very seriously. And that's because, as we've just said, their expressions of or refer back to that experience of ultimate bodhicitta, that most precious of all experiences, that wish-fulfilling gem that gives ease and freedom from suffering to all beings. So you don't want to go against that experience, that kind of experience that's given you meaning. However brief it might have been, it's given your life meaning. So in a way, it is saying something quite strong. It's saying that in some circumstances, it might be better to give your life than go against your bodhisattva aspiration. So for us, novice bodhisattvas, we're trying to develop an attitude, I suppose, of courage, and to see how important our commitment and precepts are. I mean, I don't know what I would do if I was faced with a choice of that nature. And I think all we can do is just prepare in our practice, keep practicing day by day, moment by moment, taking adversity onto the path in little ways and seeing where that leads us. when we talked about taking hardship on the path in point three, if you remember, there was a verse from Sanchideva which said, I think it said something like, if you start with the easy things, you know, in the end you can do anything. You get familiar to taking, dealing with small difficulties enables you to deal with big difficulties. So Mahayana Buddhism doesn't say you should give your life away lightly. You know, I think it's only an irreversible bodhisattva that might make that choice, or could make that choice, really. But people have been and are faced with that choice, aren't they? Not necessarily Buddhists, but people of values, people who hold values, have those values challenged, and are able to decide sometimes that, you know, they would rather give their life than transgress their values, their vows, their precepts. Presumably, they're at some kind of level where they're not afraid of death. They've managed to sort of let go into egolessness to some degree or other. They've let go of self-clinging so that they're able to not go against their values and commitments. And if you remember, again, a previous slogan that said shunyata, or emptiness, is the best protection. So, you know, if you're at that level of development, then it's not that it would be easy, but obviously you're kind of, yes, you're able to face death and not be afraid of death. So, you know, very, very courageous things have happened in the history of human beings and are still happening, no doubt. So all we can do is prepare, really, that eventuality might happen to us. So that's a gloss on Atisha's verse. So Chikawa takes that verse, which is about keeping pledges without hypocrisy, without outward show, and without partiality, and expands that and adds points into these 16 commitments of the mind training. So I am going to go through a number of points. I hope you can, you know, that doesn't kind of boggle your mind with lists and things. So the first point of Chikawa's 16 points is always practice the 3 points. It's a bit like that. Always practice the 3 points. So you have 1-1, 1-2, and 1-3 before we get on to 2. I think you did have text the other week, so you can look this up in your text. So 1, always practice the 3 points. So the first of those 3 points is not to contravene any commitments already made. Keep the promises you have made. So that's very interesting, because it goes with keep your pledges, doesn't it? So I think what this means is, if you take on the mind training as a particular form of practice, with its methods and its reflections and its aphorisms and the Tonglen practice, as a very helpful practice, if you've already taken, or you do take, you recite the refuges and the 5 precepts, or you've taken the 10 precepts, then you don't forget those. You know, you've made a commitment to that. Those principles of ethics, there's no need to forget them, thinking, oh, the mind training is better, I don't need to do that anymore, simple old 5 precepts, you know, I'm a mind trainer. You don't do that. You keep the training you've already committed to, whatever it is, whatever set of precepts it might be. You keep your promises and you add the mind training to any practices you might already be doing. You see how it relates to your existing practice. We're so often attracted to the new, aren't we, and the exciting and the exotic. Especially perhaps in the West. But as all dharmas have one point, which is to undercut self-clinging, self-centeredness, nothing you're already doing, nothing you've already taken or promised to needs to be superseded. So keep up your basic practice, deepen those practices, whatever those practices are. You can add the mind training reflections to that. So keep your promises, keep your pledges, keep your precepts. So 1, 2, don't allow your mind training to become ostentatious. Don't exhibit bodhisattva exhibitionism. As if we would. So ostentatious means pretentious, showy, or vulgar display. So you'll find quite a lot of slogans, particularly in the commitments and the precepts, which warn us against behaviour of this kind, self-congratulation, pride, bragging, exhibitionist, showing off. And you can see, you don't really need me to tell you, that's not a good thing to be doing. If all dharmas lead to one point, they're all about the same thing, and that is undercutting self-grasping, self-centeredness, including pride of self, then obviously any kind of bragging or boasting or exhibitionism or showing off goes completely against that. But, you know, we still do have pride of self. That atmaclesia is very deep, and so we may be tempted sometimes to stray into that territory a little bit. But, yes, not a good thing. And sometimes it's said under this aphorism that it might also mean that you get a bit better at taking adversity onto the path. So, you know, you get a bit kind of confident in that. You know, you don't moan about the weather quite so much or something like that. And you might then become overconfident. And as a way of boosting your ego or show off, you might seek out difficult situations in a kind of egotistical kind of way. So you want to be a hero. As it were. Now, the Bodhisattva is a hero, but you want to be a hero in a particular kind of way. You can see, you know, what that might lead to. So, you know, it's you, I'm the hero. And that might lead you to see people you're helping, as it were, as victims or patients, or, you know, you become patronising in some way. So it could be either of those things. So don't become ostentatious in your mind training. Third point of number one. Always practice the 3 points. Don't let the mind training become lopsided or partial. So again, they're fairly obvious. So everyone needs to be included in your mind training, as they do in loving kindness practice, metta bhavana, and karuna bhavana practice. But it's interesting, is it? Because sometimes we are kinder and more compassionate to those we know less well, and those, you know, we live with day by day get the rough end of the stick from us. That could be true of us. You know, it's because those people rub up against us more, don't they? We see their habits more, you know, and it's maybe easier to kind of be kind out there. That's sometimes true of some of the great philanthropists, isn't it? You know, can be very outgoing and out there saving the world, and then the poor family is kind of neglected and don't see much of them. I recently watched, it was on the radio, The Fortunes of War. It was on the radio recently, Radio 4. So I watched the DVDs because I'd missed it on the TV. And one of the characters in that is very, very concerned with others. He's always outgoing, he's always doing something out there, but his poor wife is always at home alone and wondering where he is and what he's up to. So, yes, we might do that. Or it might be the opposite. It might be that we find it much easier to practice loving-kindness, the mind training in the Sangha, because people share our values, and it's much more difficult with people who don't. It might be that we find it easier with non-human beings to be patient and kind with our pets than with human beings. It might be that we find it more difficult with inanimate objects, or easier with inanimate objects, or, you know, it's easier with the weather or not easier with the weather. So, you know, the precept is saying, or the commitment is saying, you know, don't let your mind training become lopsided or partial. There needs to be equanimity. It needs to be across the board. So it'd be interesting to ask yourself, because we're also concerned with developing the perfection of patience, so where do I experience the most impatience? Where is that trigger? Where does that arise? Where does that happen? Is it with my family, my close friends? You know, who is it with? What is it with? And when I was preparing this, I just remembered, it's a scene in my life, it's a long time ago, but it just became back very vividly, and I was washing my hair. I was in a community, I live with my very good friend Parami, and we had one bathroom, so she's in the bath and I'm at the sink washing my hair. This is typical of me, I'm quite an impatient person, so I've got my head under the tap and then I'm trying to get the top off the shampoo, which of course I should have done first really, and I can't see what I'm doing and I haven't got my glasses and, you know, hair's wet. So I'm getting quite impatient, and she's lying in the bath, you know, saying, Martin, it's very interesting, you know, you're quite patient with other people, but you're not very patient with inanimate objects, are you? So, I vow to be patient with shampoo tops. Actually, I find modern packaging, you know, I find it quite difficult. I get packaging rage, you know, you buy a sandwich at the station and you're really hungry and you can't get into it, can you? Or you buy... something, was it like a pair of headphones in those sealed things? How do you get into them? You know, and I've got very sort of fragile nails, and sometimes I don't have a pair of scissors with me. So, yes, inanimate objects and packaging, I promise. I'll try. Yeah, so don't be partial. Try and include everybody, everything in your mind training, in your development of the perfection of patience. So that's point one. Practice the 3 points. Keep your promises, don't show off, and don't be partial. Point number two. So this is similar to don't show off. Sometimes these things, they kind of repeat themselves from a slightly different angle. So change your attitude, but stay natural. Or shift your priorities, but stay how you are. So again, it's not showing off. So the mind training is said to be discreet. And for a long time, I think I said this in the first talk, it was an oral practice. It was just passed from teacher to disciple. And it was even thought to be a secret practice because it's quite difficult, particularly the taking adversity onto the path. So yes, it's discreet, it's practice without external show. I mean, this is true of all the Dharma, but it's emphasised in the mind training. So you're not practicing for any kind of attention or reputation. What matters is your own inner transformation. That's what's important. So change your attitude, but stay natural. So we are trying to change our attitude, and we're trying to change our attitude on a very deep level, remembering that a previous point said a reversed attitude shows that you are well trained. So you're really trying to reverse something very deep down. You're trying to reverse that ego clinging and self-centeredness, you know, so that you can be open to other people, you can exchange self and other, you can respond to others with as much kindness and compassion and empathy as you want for yourself. So that is not the work of a day. That's a turning about on a very deep level. And the mind training says if you practice consistently, well, that will happen. So this is what we're trying to do. So in a way, it's a big deal. But in a way, it's not a big deal. So you don't make a big show of it. It's not a big deal in that sense. You just get on with it quietly. And if you do reverse your attitude, if you do become more compassionate, more loving, more generous, that will just manifest, that will just show, won't it, in your life. You don't need to draw attention to it, you don't need to show off. Because if you do, you're doing the opposite, really, of what you've set out to do, and you're falling into the 8 worldly winds, you're falling into wanting praise, and you may get blame, you want fame, you may get infamy. So if that happens, if we're becoming ostentatious, or we're showing off, or we're not being natural with our practice, look how well I'm doing. We're depending too much, aren't we, on that other witness. When we talked about the two witnesses, the inner witness is you. You know your motivations, you know your intentions, you know what's happening. And you can look to other people in the wrong kind of way for approval and praise. So we don't do that. So the results will shine through. So stay natural. And I suppose when you first take up any kind of practice, it doesn't feel that natural, does it? It feels kind of a bit unnatural. So, with familiarisation, with familiarity, then things become easier. And that was one of the 5 powers in another talk. I think it was talk 4. The power of familiarisation is the more you practice, the more familiar things become to you, the more spontaneous they become to you, the more natural you are as you practice. That may not happen overnight either. So Sangharaksha in Wisdom Beyond Words, a little quote from him, he says, it's difficult to refer to one's spiritual attainment or insight naturally and unselfconsciously without appropriating it or exploiting it in some subtle way. So recognising this, the central Buddhist tradition encourages a healthy reticence. And then he goes on to say, if you're observing silence or celibacy or fasting or indeed any practice, it's absolutely crucial to the practice that it be performed in a cheerful and easygoing manner, in a natural kind of way. So just this kind of idea of being natural, at the same time working very, very hard on your mental states. So that's, I think, quite an important point. Change your attitude, but stay natural. Stay how you are, as it were. Don't draw attention to yourself in an egotistical way. Slight change of tack, point number 3. Don't discuss weak points. Don't discuss the shortcomings of others. We don't do that, do we? So this means in a gossipy way. The implication is that you're doing that in a sort of indirect way to boost your own self-esteem. So you're talking about other people, oh, they're really mean, or they're not really kind, or etc., etc. And the implication might be that, well, actually, I'm really quite generous. And so you're kind of, by implication, sort of praising yourself and putting others down. Or maybe you're trying to hide a fault of your own. So you're trying to feel kind of superior in some kind of way. There's a lovely quote from Naropa who said, "Samsara is finding fault with others." So obviously it's okay if it's motivated by constructive kindness. If you are for them, they're other witnesses, as it were. If you stand in a relationship of apatrapia to them, if you stand in a relationship of, you know, they do value your wise opinion, as it were. But you probably need to be invited to do that. So we do have, don't we, have assessment in the movement. We have guidelines for ordination. We have guidelines for becoming a Kaliyamitra, guidelines for being a preceptor. And usually one's invited to engage in that kind of process with the person who wants the feedback. And, well, I spent, I don't know how many years, 11, 12, as a member of the ordination team. So a lot of my activity was working with other people, kind of helping them assess themselves and how they were doing in their spiritual life, but also in the team, talking about people's readiness for ordination. So it's quite a responsibility, and I think we were always looking for better ways of doing that, doing that with kindness and empathy and patience. So you need to, if you have something to say about someone or to someone, you need to examine your own motives, don't you? Why are you saying that? You need to be really sure that you really do want to be helpful to your friend or to whoever the person is. And then whatever you think of that person, you need to reflect on that and think, when would be a good time to give them that information? Even though they might have asked you for some feedback. You know, people do, can I have some feedback? And you think, you know, you need to kind of work into that kind of conversation, don't you? It needs to be based on a lot of trust. So when would be a good time? How would you say it? Is it helpful? And, you know, you need to know someone. What is their character type? How do they respond to, you know, feedback? How is it going to work? So you need to take a lot of care if you are going to talk about others. So this is really discussing weak points, the shortcomings of others, to in some way kind of make yourself feel superior. It's very similar to the first. It's interesting that it's the first of the Bodhisattva precepts, of the 64 Bodhisattva precepts. The first precept is, it's a bad thing to praise oneself and to disparage others. It's a bad thing to praise oneself and disparage others. So again, you've got that kind of praise and blame, haven't you? You're sort of setting yourself up and putting someone else down. So you can see that that goes against your Bodhisattva aspiration. So the next point, point four, is similar, but it's slightly different. It says, don't think about the affairs of others, or don't stand in judgment, critical judgment. So it's similar to the previous one, but here I think it's, don't think about the affairs of others. So the other one is, don't discuss weak points, talk about someone behind their back, etc. It's a little bit more subtle. So here we're thinking about others rather than talking about them. And I think it's quite interesting to consider how much time we think about other people, even when we're on our own, even when we're on solitary, you know, miles away from everybody. What's going on in our mind? Well, often it's something to do with other people. I think I read somewhere, and I couldn't find this again to check it, but it was either that... maybe it's a psychologist said this, that it's either 90 or 99% of the time we spend thinking about other people, which is quite extraordinary, isn't it? So yes, just think about how much time we spend pondering the affairs of others. And what we're doing is often making assumptions about their motivations and intentions, especially when we find people difficult. So in the general run of things, I mean, obviously you might be in very, very difficult situations, but in the general run of life, people are not that difficult. You know, something might do something that sets us off that we don't like. And that thing that they do, they probably don't do that often. even if they do it regularly, it's probably only, you know, 5 minutes a day or something, some little habit that they have. This is one of the people we might live with. But just think how much time you spend pondering on that action that they've done and wondering, you know, why they've done it and why did they do it and how could they not do it and please don't do it and, you know, all that. It's as though they've moved into your mind, isn't it? You know, they've done it and completely forgotten about it. You know, they may know or not know that it drives you up the pole. So you kind of let somebody live rent-free in your brain, haven't you? So this is what this one is saying. Don't think about the affairs of others in that kind of way. And in a way, the motivations and intentions of others are unknown to us. It's like a sort of, what they call it in science, isn't it, a black box or something. We don't know what goes on in somebody else's mind. We can ask them, but often we're not even doing that. We're kind of deciding what someone's motivations and intentions are. And we just so easily jump to conclusions, make assumptions, and then we tell people what their intentions and motivations are and what they feel and think. And then we wonder why they get cross with us or upset. So, yes, don't do this. It really doesn't help. And I think it's quite interesting in non-violent communication training. There's a lot of talk about distinguishing observation. You know, you tell someone what you observe in yourself and you maybe an observed behaviour, but you're not saying why you think they did that. You're just saying, you know, when you slammed that door, I felt, did you feel? You asked them. So definitely not interpretation, analysis, judgment or assumption. All those things, none of those things bring us into empathic relationship or understanding with the other person. So don't think of the affairs of others, don't stand in judgment. So I think the rule of thumb would be to be, in a way, you know, the inner witness. You know, you can be quite tough with yourself on your own mental states because you know what they are, so you can work with those. And with other people, just give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, at least try and find out why they behave in the way that they do. Probably all kinds of reasons why they behave in the way that they do. And, you know, you don't know what they are until you try and explore that with someone in an empathic way. And I think one of the things that can help this is something we do quite a lot of in the movement, I think, still, is you know, people, if they know each other in a community or in a group or a study group, sometimes tell each other their life story as a way of getting to know each other. You know, reporting in is similar, isn't it? But if you hear somebody's life story, if you hear the whole thing from birth till today in some detail, it's amazing how, you know, you just have so much more understanding and empathy for that person because you really understand why they do the things that they do. And, you know, your response to them changes. They may carry on leaving their washing, soaking in the bath for days or something like that, you know, but, you know, it doesn't bother you so much, maybe. So, yes, you need to get to know someone. You need to understand them better. So don't think about the affairs of others. Don't let them live rent-free in your brain, your mind, and don't stand in critical judgment of them. I don't know if these kind of are in any particular kind of order, what, you know, with whether one leads to another, but it's interesting, the next one, point five, says, work on the greatest obstacle first. So this is for you, this is for you working on yourself. So a big obstacle, a big klesha, a big difficulty that you experience about yourself obviously kind of has a big effect on your life and practice. So it's interesting, it says work on that first. So it's interesting, just ask yourself, well, what is my biggest klesha, as it were, my biggest obstacle, my biggest difficulty? What trips me up the most in my spiritual practice? Use that inner witness. Also ask your spiritual friends. Get some kind of handle on it. And the implication is that if you can get that sorted, if you can get a handle on that, it's your biggest obstacle, your biggest klesha. Well, after that, everything's a breeze, everything's easy, maybe. But you need to have kindness and patience towards yourself. So I remember that one of my greatest hindrances, which is a lot less than it used to be, a great deal less, was that I suffered from very deep-seated chronic self-criticism and self-doubt as a young Buddhist. And I didn't even know that was what I suffered from. Do you know what I mean? I just was in pain. I didn't even know what it was until in a kind of very interesting conversation with Sangha, actually, that's what he said to me. He said, oh, but you, I said, why do I, you know, why does this happen? Why do I react like this? And he said, you have lots of self-doubt. And it was a bit like, oh, God, that's what it is. It was like a, you know, revelation. And I said to him, oh, what do I do about that? And he said, he looked at me again. He said, you need lots of unconditional love. Whereupon, of course, I burst into tears because I thought, oh, I've got to have unconditional love. And so he gave me his hanky and he was very, very kind to me. But it was like, oh, that's what that kind of miasma of kind of painful mental states, a lot of it is self-doubt. And then I had a kind of handle on it. But nevertheless, it was something that some people thought and said back then that was a trigger for that. It kind of, I just felt undermined, or I allowed myself to feel undermined. And I really struggled with it. I really tried to kind of deal with it or face it, do this thing, I think. But I think what I was trying to do was sort of deal with the trigger in some way, or sort that out, or work that out. Why did people think that? How could they think that? And I just felt it was like a bit like a brick wall. So in the end, I thought, I've just got to put that aside, actually. It's not that I'm not going to work with my self-doubt, but I can't quite do it in the way I've been doing it. It's not helpful. And I just need to create a better foundation. I just need to do lots more metta bhavana. I need lots of unconditional love if I can get it. I need my friends. You know, I need to do something kind of positive rather than kind of struggling with this tendency. So that really worked over time. But I think there is something in this, in you know, just knowing what your biggest triggers are, what trips you up the most, and you know, being prepared to have a bit of a look at it. Because I suppose quite often if something's that painful or that major, we have a kind of fear, don't we, about kind of going there, really. So do it kindly and do it with friends. See what your greatest obstacle is, think it over, and see if you can you know, nibble away at it. Point six. Give up all hope for results, rewards, and fruits. Give up all hope for egotistical results, hopes, rewards, and fruits, I think this means. Abandon hope, ye who enter the mind training. So hope in the Dharma is usually contrasted with fear. Hope and fear are seen as two sides of a coin. They're not seen as positive, either of them. So hope is a kind of wishful thinking for a good outcome, and fear is an anxiety about possible bad outcomes. And they're both fantasies about the future. So they're kind of fixations on possible likelihoods that you don't know whether that's going to happen or not. They're quite passive in a way, and they take us away from our present experience. So we're waiting for or looking for what it is we hope for, or we're anxious about what we fear is going to happen. And they're both expressions of the dualistic mind. They're both expressions of ego. So you hope that I, this fixed self, I will get what I want, and you fear that I will lose what I have, or I will get what I don't want. So the opposite of those, hope and fear, let go of hope and fear for that kind of reward or result or fruit, is Shraddha. Shraddha is of a completely different order. You have faith. You have faith in your practice. You have faith in the methods. You engage creatively with the practice. And, you know, we said that quote about faith is the seed, practice is the rain. You have faith that you will grow and develop. I mean, you see that happening. We've had a point that was evaluation. So it's not that you don't evaluate yourself, but you're not just kind of, you know, drifting, wishful thinking, hoping this, fearing that. You're actually kind of engaging very strongly with your mind from a basis of Shraddha. So I think you can see that quite a few of these commitments are about not appropriating our mind training to the ego. To let things take care of themselves, to practice and let things take care of themselves. There will be an accumulation of merit. There will be an increasingly purified mind stream. And maybe for us, you know, often we want quick results, don't we? We want it and we want it now. You know, we haven't got the patience to kind of engage in the practice and just let those positive effects accumulate on the path of transformation. So our motives are going to be mixed to some extent, but you know, stay in the present and have faith in your practice. Point seven, give up poisonous food. Strange. Well, you'll probably remember it, won't you? That's the thing about, you know, when things are put rather oddly, you'll probably, that might be the one you remember when you get home. Oh, I've got to give up poisonous food. Does that mean coffee? Or what does it mean? Let's hope not. So, we have a need for nurture and health, and obviously poisonous food is the opposite of that. So here, the poisonous food is doing whatever practice we do with ego, clinging, ego, grasping. Now, of course, that is going to be the case, isn't it, to some extent, because we've talked about earlier on in this series of talks the poisons of self, the atmakleshas that, you know, are deep in the structure, as it were, of our consciousness. They co-arise with ignorance if we're unenlightened. We cannot but have view of self, delusion of self, pride of self, and attachment of self. It's very deep down, as it were. That doesn't mean we can't practice. I mean, one of the things that Yogacara texts say about these four atmakleshas is that they're cognitively obscured but ethically neutral, which is very, very interesting. They're cognitively obscured, so they're not in line with reality. You know, this separate, isolated self around which, you know, you make everything happen, you see yourself at the centre of the universe, this delusional self that doesn't even actually exist because your eye is just a flow in the process of experience, that delusion of self is not in line with reality. So it's cognitively obscured, it's not true, it's based on spiritual ignorance. But they're ethically neutral, so they're kind of a given, they co-arise with ignorance. So there we are, we've got this, we fall into this delusion of self. I mean, obviously it's very, very quick, or it can be very, very quick or easy for that sense of self, that I, that pride in self, to go into unskillful behaviour. What this is saying is ethically neutral, it's a given. It doesn't have to go that way. You can practice skillfully, and by practicing skillfully, you can eventually undermine those views of self. So we're trying to give up poisonous food, we're trying to give up ego clinging, but that is, again, it's not the practice of a day, it's a long-term practice. So maybe we just need to, you know, bear in mind as we practice, you know, to bear in mind those reflections on emptiness, to cut through ego clinging. You know, just remember those slogans reflecting on emptiness: all phenomena are like a dream, the mind itself is open and empty. Just kind of bring this into your reflection so that you're kind of undermining, as it were, that sense of that tendency to appropriate everything to this fixed self. So you're trying to give up ego clinging. So you might go home, you might remember that. Mustn't eat poisonous food. You might remember this one, point eight, don't be so predictable. I thought we were supposed to be predictable. I thought we were supposed to be practicing gradually along, you know, using habitual karma to accumulate merit. Aren't we supposed to be training ourselves along the path of transformation? And now they're telling us, don't be so predictable. Sometimes this is said to be, don't be so predictable, don't indulge in self-righteousness. So I think the predictable thing that this slogan is talking about is that when someone has, as you see it, done you wrong, you fall into righteous indignation, you fall into blame, and you fall into a desire for revenge. That's predictable, that's kind of common. So we've explored that quite a lot before, blame and revenge, in a previous point. So don't be so predictable. Don't hold a grudge against those who've harmed you or you feel hurt by. Again, very similar to one of the Bodhisattva precepts, number 17. It is a bad thing. This is how the Bodhisattva precepts are, but it's a bad thing. It's the bads and the don'ts, isn't it? It's the refraining. It's a bad thing to return abuse or any of the three kinds of wrong speech that can be used against one. Don't retaliate. Don't give blow for blow, bad word for bad word. Give up your long-term memory of hurt and resentments. So again, it's in the face of, you know, hurts, others, what others seem to do to you, give them the benefit of the doubt. Consider their history and circumstances, their conditioning, help them. You know, that what they're doing is dependent on all kinds of conditions that have brought them to that point where they do something that's painful for you. Plus, it might be good to remember that your own virtue is also conditional. After all, you are not perfect, are you? We are not perfect, are we? Maybe it's good to remember that. So don't be harsh with others and lenient with yourself. So don't fall into that kind of predictable, habitual, unskillful behaviour to return abuse with abuse, to seek revenge. So some of these are more about kind of not giving in to expressions of hatred. So the next one is don't indulge in malicious gossip. Don't indulge in malicious gossip. Oh, I can't say that. Malicious gossip, jokes or sarcasm. Don't malign others. Don't be excited by witty remarks. Oh, wince. I like a bit of wit. So here we're talking about, you know, unkind teasing, sarcasm, cynicism. It doesn't mean don't have fun, doesn't mean, you know, don't have a laugh, but don't, it can so easily get out of hand, can't it, that kind of behaviour. Particularly if you're in a group of people, so easily kind of, we get intoxicated and, sometimes someone gets hurt. So this is, you know, similar to earlier ones. Don't indulge in malicious gossip, don't talk about others' weak points, don't talk about others behind their back, don't do something like that so that you feel superior. Don't do it to get revenge, don't do it to show off your own virtue, don't have fun at the expense of others. So much of modern humour is like that, isn't it, actually? So, malicious is quite a strong word, isn't it? Malicious means, you know, you have a motive to harm, to malice. It's one of those mental events from Know Your Mind. It's a kind of manifestation of hatred. So, someone on the receiving end of that, you know, could well hurt them. So you might not start out in that way with any kind of bad intention, but sometimes it's so hard to let go of the seemingly witty one-liner, isn't it? To be clever and humorous. And sometimes you're not aware enough to see that, you know, someone is, you know, actually you have touched a soft point in someone, it does hurt. So you have to sort of think about what would it be like to be on the receiving end of that. And if someone reacts to our witty remarks, well, don't wriggle out of the effect. The ethics of effect by saying, well, they're not really robust and they can't take a joke. You know, if they're upset or hurt, you know, you need to take responsibility of that. So don't make fun of people in a way designed to belittle or hurt them. Don't indulge in malicious gossip, jokes, sarcasm. Don't be excited by witty remarks. Number 10. Don't wait in ambush. You get a sense that, you know, Chikawa knew a bit about human nature. Don't wait in ambush. I think in one commentary on this, it says, well, this was, bandits and ambush was quite well known in Tibet. It was a hobby to wait in ambush for kind of trains of goods going through. I think a more Western commentator said, don't wait for someone up a dark alley. Anyway, don't wait in ambush. Don't keep a record of hurts so that you want to get even. We're back again to blame and revenge. You know, it's so antithetical to the perfection of patience and to our bodhisattva ideal. Waiting in ambush is kind of cold revenge, isn't it? You know, you're waiting. You've been hurt for some reason and you know, for some reason you haven't been able to retaliate in the moment. You haven't been able to be predictable in the moment. For some reason or other. So you kind of brood and you nurse your grudge into seething resentment. And, you know, you're determined to get back at them at some point or other. And you wait. You wait your moment. You wait until they've completely forgotten about it, if they ever knew about it. You wait your time, you wait your moment until they're blissfully unaware and they think they're safe, they're vulnerable. And then you strike in some way or other, whatever it is. Don't wait in ambush. I'm sure we've all done it. But you can see it's not in line with our aspiration to bodhicitta. It carries on along this line. Hatred, and any manifestation of hatred, revenge, blame, is said to be the greatest fault, isn't it, of the bodhisattva? Patience is the greatest virtue. Point 11. Don't strike at the heart. Don't bring things to a painful point. don't humiliate people. In a way, they're quite similar. So this is don't speak in a way that humiliates people, particularly in public. You've had one sort of not behind people's back, by drawing attention to their faults in a particular way. If you have any kind of power, as it were, don't impose it on others. Don't reveal something about someone who, you know they've got a fault that they feel tender about, they're hiding, they're not ready yet. You know, maybe you know about it, they're not ready yet to talk about it or confess it. That's up to them, that's not up to you. If someone reveals their vulnerability to you, you know, be trustworthy with that communication. Don't use it against them, of course not. They're all fairly obvious, aren't they? But obviously Chikawa thinks these things are worth saying over and over again. It's another one you might remember when you get home. This is point 12. Don't put the yak's load onto the cow. Just remember we're coming from Tibet. So don't pass the buck. The yak can bear much more, as a greater beast of burden than the cow, can just kind of bear more on its back, it's bigger. Don't pass the buck. So take responsibility for what is yours, where you've made commitments and promises and pledges that you want to do something, well, keep your word and do it. If you really can't do it, well, you have to kind of try and do something about that. So carry through your responsibilities. If you need to share them, that's fine. We, you know, work with others in a team, but make sure that you know others well. You know what other people are capable of. You don't load people with responsibilities and tasks, you know, that they're going to find really difficult and they're going to be really overburdened by. So you take responsibility. It's a characteristic of the true individual, characteristic of the bodhisattva. Don't pass the buck. So this is an interesting one, we're nearly at the end, point 13. Don't aim to win. Don't try to be the fastest. Remember, this is not a competition. So in a way you can see this relates back to things about, you know, showing off and bragging and boasting and all those kind of things. Don't take all the credit for a task if other people have helped you with it. You know, acknowledge your sources, acknowledge that other people have helped you. You know, don't seek all the limelight. I was thinking people do this, don't they, when they write a book. You know, there's always an acknowledgement page in the book. People say, oh, you know, I wouldn't, you know, be able to write this book unless, etc., etc., etc. And that's, you know, true of so much of what we do. Isn't, even though we've, you know, we're taking responsibility for a task and we need to take that responsibility, we probably had a lot of help along the way. We work with other people, we work together. It's true of so many things. You know, it's not just us. You know, it's not I did it my way, I did it all by myself. It isn't like that. I was thinking that, yeah, in a book people write acknowledgements, or sometimes people dedicate talks. I was thinking about the Oscars. It's a bit more kind of tedious in the, oh, I might thank my cat, and, you know, things like that. But I suppose the principle is the same, isn't it? That, you know, someone's up there, they've won something, and they know they wouldn't have been able to get that award unless so many other people had helped them. So acknowledge your sources. Don't seek the limelight. Don't compete. You know, there's a kind of sort of, it goes along with some of the other points, kind of when you sort of story cap, you know, it can be quite fun, can't it, you know. But, you know, it gets sort of wearing, doesn't it, in the end. Oh, I've done 3 million billion trillion 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 prostrations. So, you know, they've probably got good size and a good six pack or whatever you call it, good stomach muscles, but does it mean anything, that number of prostrations, unless they've had a spiritual effect on you. You know, you can, if you've done them by some kind of rote, or you've, you know, been counting them off for show, it's not going to mean anything. Do you need to talk about it? Do you need to tell people how many prostrations you've done in that kind of way? So watch yourself and just sort of see whether you, you know, you do try to be the fastest. Do you, when you turn up somewhere, do you get there early to get the best seat? What are you like in a food queue? These sort of basic things, you know, where you worry about, are you going to get enough dinner or not? You know, we talked last week about, you know, being at the railway station trying to get on the train, didn't we, with the elbows. So yes, you can look at those kind of things. And I suppose it's saying, you know, your spiritual life is not a competition. It's to do with inner transformation. However, not all competition is bad, is it? Sometimes competition can be healthy. It's, you know, it allows you to kind of do your best. You know, I mean, sport, athletics, all kinds of things are like that, aren't they? You have sort of targets and allows you to kind of perhaps, do better than you might otherwise do, you know, express your virya. And I was thinking about Karuna appeals, not that I've done one, but I know people who have. And I gather that on the Karuna appeal, you know, you're knocking doors to raise money, that the team as a whole is given a target of how much money to raise, and that money is going, you know, to help people who really need the money. And individuals are given a target. And I gather that is quite helpful, quite challenging. You know, you're trained, you're helped, but, you know, it's quite helpful to have something to sort of aim for. And probably a little bit of positive competition helps as well. But you can see this kind of showing off, kind of trying to win, be the fastest, is not a good thing. Point 14, nearly there. Don't be sneaky or devious. Don't act with a twist or be treacherous. It's often in Mahayana sutras, it's often talked about the bodhisattva should not be devious. So devious, sneaky, cunning, sly, manipulative. I was trying to think of an example of what that might be. I suppose it is to do with the inner and the outer not matching. You might kind of pretend to be altruistic or generous or something, and it might look like that. Actually, you want something for yourself. Don't reduce a god to a demon. So this is back to don't use teachings and practices to strengthen your ego identity. Don't get inflated or fall prey to conceit. So the practice of mind training is the god, as it were. And if you use the mind training to boost your ego, you've turned it into a demon, as it were. You've used the very thing that you're trying to use to undermine your sense of self-centeredness in the wrong kind of way. So then the medicine becomes the poison, as it were. And lastly, don't seek to profit from others' misfortunes. Don't build your happiness on others' misfortunes. Don't hope that someone else will suffer so that you can benefit from it. And I think there's all kinds of ways one might do that. So these are the commitments of the mind training, the 16 commitments of the mind training. And in the general sense, from Atisha's verse, he was saying to keep our promises, be free of hypocrisy, practice without partiality and with little show. And Chikawa's taken those and he's kind of used some which are to, you know, he's extrapolated that into slogans and aphorisms which are to do, I think, with not showing hatred, that kind of in all its forms. Not to disparage others, not to find fault, not to judge critically, not to retaliate, not to maliciously gossip, not to lie in ambush, not to strike at their weak points, not to be devious, not to win. And then there are others that are due with not appropriating the mind training to your ego sense to bring about a change, but stay natural. That's really beautiful, is just stay natural. So we're looking very closely at our own mind, attitudes, habits, and by recognising when we might behave like that, we'll edge into that kind of areas, might be drawn to do that. Well, we try and not do that. We try and apply antidotes. We weed out those attitudes so that our mind of wisdom and compassion can grow. So these don'ts shed light on behaviour that are pitfalls on the path of awakening. I think it's quite interesting in our own precepts. You know, we have positive precepts and we have the so-called negative precepts, don't we? I undertake to retrain, to abstain from taking life. So, you know, you refrain, that's the first step. So these are refraining. And I think they show that Chikawa and other teachers, like the Buddha before them, understood the possible pitfalls that spiritual devotees could well fall into. And I think they demand quite a lot of honesty of ourselves. Do I behave like this in even subtle ways? Do I think like this? And Pema Chodron calls them the naked truth slogans, which I think is very, very good. And you can see perhaps how they're connected with the perfection of wisdom, so that you cut through these attitudes, cut through those tendencies, so that our mind of wisdom and compassion can grow.